At the Table with Tony is brought to you by Trafe Hustlin'. That's www.traifhustlin.com. Your home for all things barbecue. Welcome to At the Table with Tony. My name is Anthony Sciglia, better known as Tony Mangia. And today we have a very special show. We are welcoming onto the show Daniele Terry of A Feast on History and Allison Scola of Experience Sicily. And the topic of tonight's conversation is the future of tourism in Italy. I know we are in the middle of this pandemic, and slowly Italy is waking up again. I've heard that different towns are starting to allow bakeries to open and different little shops to open and markets to open, even the cemeteries to open. So this is a topic I think that is important because a lot of people have had trips planned for the summer that have been canceled. No rhyme or reason to it. You just said everything's going to be shut down. And if you were going to go to Italy, now you have to go through different routes and different countries because you can't travel directly anymore. So there is a lot to unpack, I guess, no pun intended. So again, I want to thank you ladies so much for taking some time out to come onto the show. Let's start off by talking a little bit about your backgrounds, and then we'll get into like the meat and potatoes of the show, talking about what we think will be the future of tourism, of travel to Italy, and even to a certain extent to the world, because like I said, this coronavirus pandemic has changed the way we do everything. We constantly hear now in the news the new normal. When we go to a restaurant, will there only be at half capacity? Will there be shower curtains between the tables and the booths? Will we have to wear a mask when you're eating? You're just crazy stuff. So again, thank you for coming on. First, we'll start off with Daniele. Daniele, tell us a little bit about yourself, about your company, and then we'll talk to Allison.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm Daniele, and I have a company called Feast on History, which is brings people on small group food and wine tours to a part of Italy called Cilento, which is just a little bit south of the Amalfi Coast. And I work with my family there who own a property called Borgo La Pietraia, and it's very off the beaten path. And we had a full roster of sold-out tours this year, which, of course, have all been canceled, and are in close contact because my cousins are there in Italy. You know, we talked to them every couple of days. We're always just texting on WhatsApp, getting the update, finding out what's going on. And in a way, it's been like a voice from the future because they've been telling us what's going on there. And we can sort of find out, you know, a week, 2 weeks behind them on everything. And then here in New York City, I have Arthur Avenue Food Tours, which does food tours of Little Italy in the Bronx, the most intact Little Italy in the United States. And we have been completely reimagining what we're doing there. We're actually starting a pretty surprising online business. Hmm. We're doing online cooking classes, corporate team building events now, and we're also doing food boxes. And that has been a pivot that came about very, very quickly. A lot of creativity and experimentation, but people are responding to it really well, which tells me that even though we cannot travel right now and nobody can predict the future about exactly when, people are no less curious than they ever have been.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, again, I think that this is definitely, if one good thing comes from this coronavirus pandemic is that we've had some time to experience different things. So whether it's going back into the kitchen and cooking, whether it's picking up, I have all my books here. If it's picking up a book, actually speaking of Arthur Avenue, here's from Body to the Bronx. it has given us opportunities to kind of experience things, maybe not so much hands-on. And I can see the one thing that they always saying social distancing. I hate that word, social distancing. Use the word physically distant. You use the phrase physically distancing because socially we're still having a conversation. Yeah, we're still being social. We can still get on our phones and WhatsApp our cousins in Italy. Yeah. And so the social distancing, I really don't like physically distancing. So yeah, it is interesting that we are able to then experience things in ways that we haven't been able to experience it. And a lot of it's even through these live streams or through, never heard of this. I use StreamYard now. I never even heard of StreamYard. It's Zoom. There's all these different these services that are popping up that are really helping people to connect and then disseminating information out there. So again, thank you, Daniele, for joining us today.
Thank you,
Allison from Experience Sicily. Give us a little bit about you, about your background.
Well, I Experience Sicily is a boutique travel company, and we do small group tours for 12 people and fewer throughout the year. Each one is a little different, and I also design custom itineraries for people who go to Sicily, who tell me exactly, you know, what their passions are, what their interests are, and then we match them up with amazing guides and amazing experiences so that they really can have an authentic experiential itinerary in Sicily. And I work with my cousin who's based in Palermo. So it's really like family oriented in terms of how we plan everything. So we've got really insider contacts throughout the island. I have an awesome connection with so many guides and so many excursion operators, and great relationships with different agriturismi, which are small family run inns usually, and hotels, all different kinds of like accommodations. So we can really, we have a whole portfolio of options for people to really present them with a very special, special tour of Sicily, that they'll never forget. Here in New York, I do a lot of events that promote Sicily so that people can really experience Sicily here in New York, which of course now with the problems we are experiencing, events are just not happening. One of those events is the Cannoli Crawl, which is a walking and food and history tour. It's in downtown Manhattan. And sadly, yes, this is not happening right now. And I'm talking to some of my connections on the Cannoli Crawl too, because I'm trying to put a Cannoli Crawl tour that we can do online also. But it's very hard because one of the things that we compare is cannoli in Sicily versus cannoli here in New York. And we can't get the ricotta from Sicily right now. So it sort of creates a problem in terms of making that pivot, like Danielle was saying about doing a box, but it is in the planning, and once we can get those importing streams open again. So yeah, so that's a little preview of what I do.
Excellent. Well, again, I mean, you, so there is, it seems that you ladies are trying to adapting to our current situation, but the main topic of this conversation of the show is about the future of tourism to Italy. And really, you know, Mel, correct me if I'm wrong. I know that the north of Italy was hit tremendously. They, you know, really just the amount of the death and the devastation up there caused by this coronavirus is terrible. But on the other hand, for the most part, southern Italy, not to say that it hasn't been affected, I think that it's been affected in other ways. I think by tourists not coming, their economy is being more affected. Is that a fair assessment?
Definitely. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I've spoke to my friends like in Caserta, which is near where Danielle works mostly. And my friends in Sicily, of course, my cousins. And yeah, their big complaint is that there aren't a lot of cases there. Like in the mm-hmm. province of Caserta, there's zero cases of coronavirus. So why are we closed? Why are we in this situation? My argument is that when I talk to them, I said, well, you don't have it now, but mm-hmm. things spread and it's a small country. I mean, basically this Italy is like, you have to imagine it the size of New York State in a way. So people can travel from Buffalo to New York City pretty easily and bring with them what they have. And that's what happened. The cases that are in Sicily, for example, which right now it's like 3,200 cases, which is nothing compared to what we're experiencing here in the tri-state mm-hmm. area. Those cases are people mostly who came from the north right before lockdown and brought it with them and then transferred it to family members and people who they had contact with. Yeah. So yes, the economic issue is probably more grave to them than the actual virus itself at this
at this time, which is not to say, like you said, not to say that, you know, once the economies and once the air travel starts to come up again, that it can then be transferred, let's hope that I know they say sometimes like the weather might affect it. If it gets warmer, it might lessen the things. But again, we don't know what's going to happen then come next fall and next winter. Will the same thing happen? Will we have to shut down the whole world again because of this virus if there is no vaccine or no treatment?
Yeah. I mean, for my biggest concern, which is what I'm trying to explain to people I know in southern Italy, is that the Southern Italian, yes, they have national health care. And in fact, Italy in general is rated second on the WHO list in terms of health care and how it's provided. However, the South versus the North is extremely different. And the South can't handle the amount of cases if they were to rise. And so that is my concern. And I think that's what obviously government officials, that's what their concern is that the healthcare system in the South can't handle an onslaught of cases. So I think that's why they continue to be so prudent with the lockdown there.
Yes. Danielle, have you been here? I'm sorry. Go ahead, Danielle.
It's different from town to town. It's so different. I mean, we've seen those videos of the Italian mayors yelling at people. They're entertained by them. Oh, one of them, the president of the region of Campania, De Luca, has been very, very strong. He's the one that was famous for saying that he was going to bring the lancia fiamme, flamethrowers, to somebody's graduation. in the town of Capaccio, where we are, they've been so strict. They've even put up, like, on Pasquetta, the day after Easter, when everybody usually goes to the beach or the mountains for a picnic, they actually set up police barricades. It's like, we have zero cases, and we want to keep it that way. And then there are other towns that don't have all of those restrictions. But, you know, one of the big things about Southern Italy for tourism is so much of their tourism comes from Northern Italy, especially Puglia, which is where so many wealthy people who live in Milan have a second home, have a beach home. So they, right now the restrictions are that people have to stay in their regions for the time being, that they can't go down south for the summer. And yeah, there's mixed reactions. There are people that are freaking out about the economic ruin that's going to cause. And then there are other people that are like, stay away.
Yeah, you know, I was actually just talking to my cousin last weekend, and she was saying that they were just, I think this week, they were just going to be allowed to, I guess, kind of leave their house or leave their town even. But again, they weren't allowed to travel to, you know, to the mainland, because they're from Sicily, so they weren't allowed to travel to the mainland. I don't think they were even able to travel to other provinces. I think it was kind of just constrained to their town or their little area. And actually, I was talking to her yesterday for Mother's Day, and she said that she saw her son for the first time in 3 months, like physically saw her son, not doing WhatsApp or doing, you know, these FaceTime calls. So really, you know, I mean, I think in a way, again, I say, you know, the Italians, we are a very social people. We love to be around people. We love to hug people. We love to kiss people. And to not to be able to even, you know, when I go visit my grandmother, or I visit my in-laws, you know, you have to kind of just wave. I mean, you can't share what we are so used to sharing is that physical connection. So my question is, how can we get through this? How can we get back to be able to share this physical connection, whether it's, you know, person to person or more widely a physical connection to our homeland, to our ancestral homeland, to Italy. So what do you think the way forward is?
Well, I mean, there's so much. I think like the first thing before this conversation is that we just don't have a lot of information. There's a lot of waiting and seeing, and sometimes that can be the most chaotic because we want certainty. Mm-hmm. And nobody has a crystal ball, and nobody really knows. So like everything has to be done, as we say in the South, piano, piano, slowly, slowly, little by little, which was like my grandmother practically had that tattooed on her forehead, little by little. So I think in that sense, we have to, you know, really take heart in the fact that whether we're thinking about traveling or whether we're thinking about just seeing our friends and family, we all have to take it very slowly and with a lot of caution. But I also think that what it brings about is kind of a borderless world in a way, in terms of connecting and finding and seeking information. So, for example, so many people have of our generation have connected with their Italian relatives because of Facebook. They were able to, you know, through ancestry.com or whatever, connect with people, and then they find that their cousins who are their own age are on Facebook. I think a lot more people are digging into ancestry research. They've got the time right now. I know like ancestry.com subscriptions have gone through the roof. So I think it's a time for sort of researching, connecting with people, learning Italian if you're looking to go to Italy. I think sort of that, like, you know, kind of tourism where people just kind of drop into a place, spend a couple of days and zoom out. I think that's over for a while. And I think that when we do travel again, we're going to have to focus on a place Hopefully have a more meaningful experience of it. So maybe some more research prep, language, study, all of those things can become a nice appetizer.
That's a very interesting point. You're right. In a way that I think that it could give us, even though it kind of makes us have to wait longer to go to these places, it gives us kind of more of a yearning for it. So if we're able to learn some of the language or even start cooking some of the foods at home, we could really immerse ourselves in the culture without even leaving our front door. We could kind of
probably your relatives too. I mean, just getting a phone call from Italy was like, oh my God, the phone is going to ring. We all like sit around it and stare at it for like 40 minutes before, God forbid, you have to use the bathroom. Or like people would buy a plane ticket like over a year in advance for their travel. Mm-hmm. You know, we're so spoiled. We've had this incredible golden age of travel, which I think for better or for worse is over. There's some good reasons that that's ending too. I think over-tourism is a problem, but sadly, I mean, yes, it's good and bad. We're going to have to become much more patient and much more thoughtful about when we go, how we spend our money and what we do when we're there.
That's true. Allison, could you add to that?
What Danielle is saying in terms of what Arthur Avenue Food Tours is doing, having these online cooking classes and having boxes where you receive the products of the food you would have been tasting on the walking tour, for example, and then having a meetup online to do that. These are experiences that we can do now. That's one of the things I'm working on. I'm planning on having a Sicily trivia challenge next week, and I'm going to be doing pasta making chiacchierone. So like we'll chat while we make pasta. So this is how we have to do things now until it's safe, basically. So there's a lot of ways to connect to the culture that we love, but doing it at home right now. And unfortunately, yeah, we are limited to the computer. I mean, I even know, like, I wanted to visit my mother who lives 2 hours away. You know, she's in Connecticut, and I would have loved to go see her yesterday, even just at a distance. But the idea of like traveling on the highway, what if something happens to the car? And then what if something, you know, if that happens, what do you do? So, you know, these are, unfortunately, when you live even within driving distance, but a bit too far, you have to be really prudent about your behavior, because you're going to be putting a lot of people in jeopardy if you go make that 2-hour trip. Yes. So we have to just find other ways to connect to what the things we love and the people we love.
So the 1,000-pound elephant in the room is you ladies had tours booked, right, throughout the year.
Yep.
And now everything is done. Everything is shut down. No more tours.
Well, I have yet to cancel my September and October tours. So I'm not giving up. I have a glimmer of hope. And in fact, yesterday I spoke to my friend in Rome, and I was speaking to my cousin in Palermo, and both of them were saying, don't give up hope, because it's looking good for September. There's a possibility mm-hmm. that you could travel and that people could come here. So I'm not giving up hope. Maybe I'm foolish, but I think in four weeks I might know something else. I don't know.
I guess really now it's just a day by day type thing, you know, or even a week by week, because really things are changing constantly. So what kind of, I know this is a heartbreaking thing to ask, but you know, what kind of goes through your mind when you say, listen, like, what, I don't know. I don't even know how to explain it. Like, what do you have to say to your group saying, okay, we have to cancel the tours, but we'll reschedule for, you know, a future date. So kind of what's going through your mind when you're first hearing these, you know, that they're shutting down flights, they're shutting down tours. Kind of give us a little bit of the insight into what you're thinking in your mind and in your heart.
Danielle, you want to take this one first?
we were invested in all of this coronavirus news long before I think most people were, because we were all paying attention to what was happening in Italy. And I think, you know, we made somewhat of a, we were watching what was happening in Italy, and somehow, yes, knowing that even though they have the second best healthcare system in the world, I'm still like, there's like a ridiculous prejudice in my mind of like, oh, Italy's being Italy and they can't get this thing under control. Not really thinking that it was going to happen here in quite the same way, which mm-hmm. is really, I think back on that now, I'm like, what was I thinking? It was so silly. So it happened slowly. We were making the decision. It was a few of my tours were with some other partners. we had people coming from all over the world. So there were some people coming from Australia that said, hey, we booked these tickets, we're coming no matter what. And then we had other people who were older and much more concerned. Ultimately, I think we, as much as heartbreaking as it was, because you lose not only the money, but like all the work that you, that went into it, you know, that's all now going to be unpaid, money that you laid out that you now lost, all of these things. It was also a relief because the liability that was going to go along with this and the worry, I mean, you don't go on vacation to be worried. You go on vacation to completely let go and have a good time. And so there was also at the same time a sense of relief that things were going to be canceled and then we were going to figure out something else to move forward, which is what we've been working on since. Allison, I don't know, what's your experience been?
Yeah, well, it's heartbreaking is the way to describe it for sure. And I had my friends here from Sicily. We were doing an event for Carnevale on March 25th. And that was the first day in Sicily where they started to react to what was going on. They closed the schools. And I just knew that day, I was thinking, great, this is it. I just know this is what the rest of the year is going to look like. So my heart was breaking that day. Like Danielle said, it was like 2 weeks before everyone here understood what was going on. You know, I understood what was ahead. And, you know, I have also independent clients who had tours booked for March and April and May, and all of that also had to be canceled. And like Danielle said, you know, we did a lot of work leading up to these tours. We spent money advertising and, my feeling is that as a consumer, I would have wanted my whole tour deposit back or my whole tour cost back as well. And so that's something I did. Other companies didn't do that. They kept something or they just said, no, you're postponing till next year. That's it. Those are the big companies and the big companies that like Danielle and I, we're personal people. You know us. We pick up the phone when you call us. So for us, it is the option is return everybody's money because we're buying goodwill for the future. But yeah, there was a whole lot of work that went into getting those registrations and setting all those tours up. Luckily, the way that I work in terms of my independent traveling clients is that I work on a fee basis in terms of how I charge a fee for everything that we do in terms of the work, the research, everything that we do to help them other than just the excursions and hotels. So I was able to keep some of that because we had done the work. However, when they decide to go next year or the year after, then we'll pick up the rest of the fee, for example. So I was able to negotiate some of that. Other travel advisors weren't so lucky because they work on a commission basis and they don't get those commissions till after the trip happens. So I feel sorry for them. But I'm sort of happy that I decided to go in this other way of working because it did benefit me in this case. It's a very transparent way of working for independent itinerary planning. But really it's not even just this year. It's really the 6 years before the work that, I know that I have done to build my business, to build my brand, and to gain people's trust. And so my whole life has been building Experience Sicily since 2013. So when this was happening, it wasn't just about losing 2020. I could, you know, looking into the future, what is going to happen with travel in general, like you're saying, and my whole life has been about building this business. So there's been a lot of grieving and a lot of mourning that's been going on. So,
yeah, we had an article come out about Arthur Avenue Food Tours in the New York Times on March 20th. And it was supposed to come out at Christmas time and I was anticipating and I couldn't wait. And I was in contact with the author, Helene Stepinski, who wrote Murder in Matera, and we became BFFs. And then it came out at like the worst time. And I said, oh my God, this would be such a huge deal. This would be such a moment to celebrate any other day but today. So yeah, it's true. It's like all the buildup to all of these things that are happening. There's so much work that went into it.
But like you said, we have to be hopeful. We have to hope that when this is all over, again, it will be a new normal. But yet, to a certain extent, we can get back to maybe traveling again. And so my next question is, are you or can people contact you maybe to gauge some interest about what they want to do next year or even in 2 years. So, I mean, do you think that maybe also, I guess the second part of the question is, do you think that maybe now people, I guess we kind of talked about it in a way, but do you think people will be more purposeful and when they make these tours or when they book these tours that they, you know, that they want this special experience? So, you know, I'm trying to think of the proper way to say it is like, do you know, will they be more, I guess, determined and purposeful in where they want to travel in the future? Not just to say, go with these big box tours that take you, you know, 20 stops in like 5 days and your head's spinning by the time you get off of one bus, you have to get back onto another bus. You know, whereas you ladies, you really are kind of diving into one particular area as opposed to 10 cities throughout the whole country. So I guess, I mean, I don't kind of want to off the beat about that question, but like, you know, kind of talk to that point in a way.
Well, you know, here's the silver lining for like little tiny operators like us. The big guys have had to lay off huge amounts of staff. And these are companies like those big bus tours that make their money on margins. Mm-hmm. And if they are now filling up a bus with all those people, they're not making money. They pay their guides very little. Like, this is sort of like the really bad side of the travel industry, is that there's a lot of exploitation. And, you know, take a city like Venice, for example. Is anybody making any money? Is Venice any better off for having, you know, thousands of tourists come off a cruise ship every day? No, it's not. Like, Florence, a place that I have always loved, has, you know, been abandoned by the people that live there because they're renting out their apartments on Airbnb. And you know, so big companies like Airbnb, like TripAdvisor, which is kind of everybody in the travel agency has a special advisor. I'll just leave it at that. They have laid off tons of staff. So they're not going to be able to so easily like just jump back on. I mean, yeah, they have reserves, but they're also, you know, really profit driven machines. They're not in it for the passion. They're not in it because they really know a place and they really care about a place. I'm not going to say that kind of tourism isn't going to come back someday. It probably will, but not anytime soon. And so when people are ready to travel, you know, I think certainly small operators, the family businesses who can lay low and do other things for income in the meantime, will be here. And we're in constant communication. We're actually invested in the place. So we'll know exactly where to bring people. And there's going to be really, really, really good deals. I mean, I think the big question, of course, is like air travel and when and how is that going to be safe? I think we're also going to see a huge spike in luxury travel from the people that can, like, you know, share a private jet. And so we're going to get a lot of that really high-end stuff. But, yeah, when people are able to travel again, the deals are going to be great. And I'm glad that we work in Italy because nobody – like, people will always want to go to Italy. Like, that will never stop. Italy will never stop being, like, people's number one dream. And so we'll wait.
Yeah, to continue with that, the luxury travel market is going to be the travel market that's going to come back first. And because I really think that also senior citizens who are retired and have the money, they're not worried about losing their jobs because they didn't have a job. They're on a fixed income or they have the money to travel and they were planning to travel. So this is my market. I mostly work with people who are over 50. I mostly work with people who are looking for 4 and 5 star experiences. And so I'm ready to receive those people and to give them what they want. I also see, and I've been speaking with some of the luxury villa companies that I work with, because I think that villa rental is going to be one of the ways people are going to go. And, you know, they're going to want to travel with people they know. They're going to want to travel with their loved ones, their family members, their best friends, and rent a villa and stay, like you're saying, sort of close to where they can control their environment. Because obviously cleanliness is going to be really important. But I also think that going to a place like Sicily, which is really off the beaten path, I think the big cities like Rome and Venice and Florence are not going to be where people want to be. And I think people are going to be looking for going to the small villages, going to do some hiking, some walking, touring, really looking for open air archaeological sites. They're going to want to be away from the crowds. And so the people who can afford to do that and who want to do that kind of tourism, those are going to be our first customers coming back in 2020, 2021, and probably until 2022, 2023 is we're not going to see that that mass tourism coming back. So, and you know, cruises, I don't know, airlines, I don't know, all these are up. You know, there was an article yesterday in the Times about the airline industry. And is the airline industry going to recover from this? Is it going to be possible?
I saw something about Carnival Cruises like launching cruises in August and that they're already sold out. But I'm like, I used to work in PR. I'm not 100% sure about that. Maybe I could be wrong, but
right. Well, speaking of PR. So Tony, one of the things that you mentioned when we were talking about doing this was the Sicily vouchers, right? What is this offer of Sicily's going to pay you to, you know, right? So this was an idea that the Minister of Tourism, his name is Manlio Messina in Sicily, he came up with this idea. And think of it like Groupon, you know, where you can go on a website and you put in that you want to do these certain things and you're sort of asking for a good price on them. So this was an idea, and he didn't have the approval to do this, didn't have the money to do it, but somehow the Times of London got the story and the Daily Mail got the story. And once they got the story, then it started spreading out to all these blogs. And so very good, smart PR, as Danielle's saying, the story got out so fast internationally. I mean, like, people were just emailing me, is this true? Is this true? And I was like, well, it's true that they're proposing the idea. It hasn't yet been approved. Well, since then, I mean, it took about a week or so. But obviously, the PR pressure was put on the Sicilian parliament and also the Italian government to say, okay, we've got to find this $50 million worth of money to put into the Sicilian tourism business. So it worked because they did pass this concept. It has yet to be launched, but the PR machine worked for them. So you can use, like Carnival is doing, like you're saying, Danielle, that you can use it to your advantage. What it really is intended for, however, is not for us. It's not really intended at this point for international tourists, because we are not allowed to go there. There's an international travel ban. It's really intended for Sicilians, who obviously have their income is lower now because of obviously the situation, or Italians. It's really, the idea is to get Italians and get Sicilians to discover Sicily, because they, most of the time, they might go on their own vacation. They go somewhere else. Yeah. They go to Mexico, you know, they go to France. So the idea is to keep Sicilians in Sicily, spending money in Sicily, and also Northern Italians and Italians from the mainland to come to Sicily. So hopefully it will still be around. Maybe they'll renew it in time for us to take advantage of those vouchers. However, at the moment, it's not really intended for us.
Okay, well, we have to hope. We have to hope in the future that it will trickle down to us Americans that are going to visit. I do want to talk a little bit about. So each of you have your own. Obviously, you were talking a little about. So Allison, you concentrate on Sicily, and Danielle, you concentrate on an area, pretty much an untouched area of southern Italy called the Cilento.
Yep.
So can you kind of, Danielle, can you, for you, my question for you is, can you kind of explain where the Cilento is, what the Cilento is, for people that have, because really, I mean, I know what the Cilento is because part of my family is from that neighbor, from that area. But most people say Cilento, like, you know, they have no idea what that means. Is that a person's name? Is that what is Cilento?
Cilento is part of Campania, and Campania is a state. So like New York is Campania, and Cilento would be like the Hudson Valley. And it's just south of the Amalfi Coast. So imagine the same Amalfi Coast coastline, except not all built up, because most of it is part of a national park. And the parts of it that are, or the features of it that are the most famous, one is Buffalo Mozzarella, and then the other is the temples at Pestum. But it's really, one of the best things about it is that it is the birthplace of the Mediterranean diet. So there was an American physiologist, Ansel Keys, who was living in the Cilento in the 50s, was noting how people live to these incredibly long lives. Yep, there's some good schkettel and beans there. And began the Mediterranean, the five-country study, and, you know, really broke down everything that was in the Cilento diet as to what made it so healthy. So, you know, this is one of the things that we're sort of hopeful about for the future, in that this has always been a region that's quiet, always been a region that has, like, amazing food, clean food, such a pristine environment, crystal clear blue waters. And, you know, it's never going to be a place that's super crowded. It's just not set up for that. So, yeah, that's what we're doing. And what we're doing now is, I'm sort of, because we, borders are meaningless right now and everything's online, we are merging what we do in Cilento with what we do on Arthur Avenue. So we've been doing this thing called the Arthur Avenue Cookbook Club, which is I send people recipes 5 days a week for 6 weeks. And then at the end, they get a printed cookbook that compiles everything. So we're in week five, we're almost done with the first book. And with the second version of the club, what we're doing is we're bringing in cooking videos from Cilento. So my cousin Ariana and her partner Mario, who's the chef at the property, they are in the process of recording videos. And they're going to focus on the Mediterranean diet, because I think we're all thinking right now about, you know, eating better, being healthier, taking care of ourselves, probably eating less meat because of what's going on in the food supply here. And so if we're not traveling and everything's online, why does there need to be a separation between Little Italy and Italy? We're going to bring it all together.
And Allison, obviously Sicily is, it's again, you know, people know Sicily, they hear Sicily. It's kind of like the middle of the Mediterranean, but really not many people visit there. I mean, I know like where my wife's family is from, they're from Ragusa. So a lot of people from like Poland or Germany, they'll come to like the Club Med down there. But really most of Sicily is really not, again, it's an untouched paradise. So can you talk a little bit about Sicily?
Oh, I could talk a lot about Sicily. Where do you want to start? Yeah, I mean, there's 3,000 years of human history there. There's 7 UNESCO World Heritage Sites. This is, we're looking at Valley of the Temples right here. This is my group from July. One of the things I do is I bring people to really remote towns. This particular group was the tour I did last July called Life in a Remote Sicilian Town. We stayed in a little town called Licodia Eubea, which is in Catania province, not far from Ragusa. Actually, it's a little closer to Ragusa. And we lived in apartments in the town, and we had 10 days there. Every day we would leave the town to go and see a UNESCO site or have another experience, but we'd come back in the evenings, or we would actually have an experience in the town during the day, depending on what day it was. But the really cool thing was that we were the Americans. They don't get a lot of tourism in this town, so they were fascinated by us. So every evening, when we would go back and passeggiata with everyone, they would try, you know, they talked to us. If we spoke Italian, you had a chance to practice your Italian. If you wanted and were willing to speak with someone in English who was wanting to practice their English with you, you had that opportunity. So Sicily has everything from the hustle and bustle of Palermo with the fascinating markets that are thousands of years old, to these little remote towns where Sicilians are so curious and excited to see you and happy to share their culture with you. And despite any language barrier, there's a way to communicate and a way to have a great time together. The food is different from what you're going to find in on the Italian peninsula. But similar to what Danielle is saying, it's very clean food, the Mediterranean diet, lots of olive oil, obviously. Here we have a pasta pasta alla norma, which is a very simple pasta dish with tomato sauce. And this is ricotta salata on top with fried eggplant. Eggplant is a very important staple in the Sicilian cuisine. I always say eggplants, like the potato is to the Irish, eggplant is to the Sicilian. So you're going to eat a lot of eggplant when you're in Sicily, especially in the summer. But really, is the 3,000 years of human history that will attract you on the surface. You're going to be attracted to go to see some of the best Doric temples preserved in today. you're going to be attracted to the Arab Norman architecture and history, which is really fascinating. You're going to want to see Ragusa, especially now if you've been home watching Inspector Montalbano and you want to see the sites of where Inspector Montalbano has been filmed. But that's what draws you in. In the end, the thing that you really will remember is the people you met. So it's going to be the fishmonger. It's going to be the guy in the market who's making the baskets that you are. You get to watch him and learn how he's making the baskets. It's going to be the barrister at the bar that you go to every morning to have a cappuccino. Really, in the end, it is the people, and Sicilians are just wonderful, wonderful people, and they're so happy to have you there. And I think after this passes and it is safe to travel, they're going to be so thrilled to welcome us back to Sicily and to host us there. What else do you want to know?
Well, Sicily, I mean,
my friend Claudio in the market in Siracusa, making baskets with the river reeds weeping willow branches, etc. So you really can get into all these traditions, all these ancient ways of life in Sicily. It's kind of like frozen in time. Many things are really frozen in time. And the thing I think that's fascinating about it are the contrasts between the antique and the modern right next to each other. And that is extended to the cuisine as well, the bitter and the sweet right within the same dish, for example.
Yeah, that's, I mean, one of my favorite Sicilian dishes is caponata. I absolutely love it because it's a mix of, I mean, first of all, eggplant pasta, I could probably eat for every single meal, breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and I wouldn't get tired of it. That and pizza. Pizza would be another thing that I can eat 24/7, but you're right though. The cuisine, I mean, even the cuisine of the Cilento, but the cuisine of Sicily is like nothing else there is in the rest of Italy. It really is its own. And again, because Sicily has that history. It was around before the Romans.
Long before the Romans. And in fact, probably the Romans had the least amount of influence on the culture because they weren't really, they were occupiers. They enslaved the people of Sicily. So, they didn't even teach the locals Latin, for example, just to give you an example. The locals continued to speak their ancient Greek languages or, their Carthaginian, derivative, whatever it was. But that's something very important about the cuisine. The cuisine reflects all of that, all of the invaders, all the people who colonized, all the people who contributed. So North Africa and the Arab culture is a huge influence, and you're going to see that in the cuisine, like couscous being one of the main dishes on the west side of the island, for example. So, yeah, there's a...
And the language. This is a book here. It's by Antonino Provenzano. He lives in America now, but he's a Sicilian author. And just, you know, just kind of going through the book.
He writes absolutely beautiful poetry.
He does. But I mean, and actually what's beautiful about it is that he doesn't put it in Italian. He writes in Sicilian. And Sicilian really is, to me, you know, people say, okay, oh, well, you know, Sicily, it's an old language. It's a dying language. Speak Italian. No. You have to know, even if it's Neapolitan, even like the Bade is a dialect, forget it, that's like Chinese, but still you have to preserve these dialects and these traditions, because if you don't, it's just
going to be and I don't even call them dialects. I call them languages, because dialect is really, that's the modern Italian government trying to minimize the importance of the languages that people spoke before they were taken over in 1860. So Sicilian was its own language. It was its own, it had its literature, it had poetry, you know, and this is true for Neapolitan as well. You can't deny that these are languages. So I'm adverse to calling them dialects. They're alive and well. They're very alive and well. When you walk in the streets in downtown Palermo, in small villages, people are speaking Sicilian. And on Facebook, they're writing in Sicilian to each other. I don't know, Danielle, if you find this with people you know in Campania, if they're using their dialects on Facebook or what have you. But I imagine.
In parts of the ocean, too. It's definitely like I'll see people, I know, like they're writing in Italian, but then when they're like ticked off about something or they're like, Or they're really kind of talking about something that's really just meant for like people that know them in their towns. You know, if they're writing about like regional politics or whatever, then yeah, they'll often write a Neapolitan. But often it is for punctuation. It is for humor or rage.
I mean, I have a friend. I think we all have a mutual friend, Patrick O'Boyle. And whenever I spoke to him, he always speaks to me in Neapolitan. So I'm trying to figure out, because my wife's family, my wife's first generation is Sicilian American, and her family, they speak is Sicilian. I love to hear her mother and her grandmother speak it, because that's how I'm learning about my culture as well. Like I said, I'm part Sicilian American. I'm also part Chilentano. So I had the whole, actually, speaking of the Chilento, here is my book.
That's a great book. that's an amazing book. Yeah,
the next actually was a gift to me from my friend Patrick. He because actually, if you notice what's in it is La Madonna. This is his Madonna that they have in. Actually, we're having a feast this weekend. We're gonna do a virtual feast on StreamYard. So I'm looking forward to that. But yeah. So I mean, really, the languages, like you said, the language. They're not dialects. They are these languages. They are beautiful. And really, we have to preserve them, because, but like anything else, if we don't preserve it, we're gonna lose it. And I think that, like you said, Allison, they try to teach, you know, proper Italian, but really, what's proper about it? You know, it comes from the north. It's a northern, and again, we're talking to two southern Italian or three southern Italians, all three of us. So we have to be proud of our heritage, because really. I don't know. I'm probably going to piss some people off, but I think the Southern Italians are the best. I think our food's the best. I think our people are the best. I think the languages are the best. There's just something so special about it. And that they are not to say that somebody from Florence isn't warm or somebody from Venice isn't warm, but there's just something about the Sicilian or the Southern Italian mentality that they just seem, you know, maybe they, I think the Sicilians get a bad rap saying that they're very, you know, they don't like outsiders, because I think that's all a bunch of BS. I think that if you are an honest person, if you come at it with an open heart, I think they're going to welcome you with open arms. I mean, I don't know can you guys talk to that about the personalities of Southern Italians?
Well, yeah, I mean, obviously partial, but I would say though, I think like the heart of Italy is like rural Italy. I mean, even if you go to some of the small towns around the north, and they have their languages too, very much so, that like are put aside but are just spoken locally. I mean, I just feel like whenever you go to the small towns in the middle of nowhere, that's where you get the best food. That's where you meet the coolest people. It's, you know, yeah, Florence, Venice, Rome, Milan, they're great, but they're international cities. And I don't know. I'm partial to the small hills. And, so, and one actually, I don't know that much about this other than this one article that I read that I saw on Facebook yesterday. So grain of salt, but it did say that there has been the small towns, many of the abandoned small towns, especially in the South, have been seeing people return to them during this. People that like have live in the cities and are like looking for a refuge, much in the same way that I'm not at home in Manhattan right now and I'm in New Jersey. So I think that, you know, we've been really, for like Southern Italy in particular, really worried about all these beautiful small towns that where we all have our roots and what's going to happen to them. You know, you're selling them for a dollar, all these things. Well, I think it's actually pretty great if Italians rediscover them and do something with them, because, you know, the authenticity thing, right? I mean, they're continuing a tradition. We have a break from that tradition, and we have strong threads to it as well, but there's no better community of people to move into those than the people that are from them.
Absolutely. Allison?
Well, certainly there are very differences within the regions. My friend who's in Venice is very different from my cousin who's in Palermo. They've had very different experiences. And we have to think of it like us here in the United States. So someone from Vermont is going to be very different from someone who's from Georgia. Just the mentality, the difference of lifestyle is going to be different. And so that is true in Italy. Of course, I mean, I'm obviously partial to the South and Sicily. However, you can't deny the great works of art and culture that Northern Italians have brought to us. So, and to Western civilization. So I hate to completely knock Northern Italy. But certainly, yes, there's a big difference between, like Danielle's saying, I mean, these are international cities. So when you get into someone, like, let me think about it, when you're walking around New York, I mean, New Yorkers, when you ask them a question, when you ask them for help, they're going to be extremely helpful and very happy to host you in our city. So someone in Venice or someone in Rome is going to be that way too. But if you're not having that interaction, they're going to ignore you like you're an annoying tourist, just like I would of anyone walking through Times Square who's in my way. Get out of my way. So, you know, we have to think about it from that point of view. But yes, like Danielle's saying, I think that there already was, and Franco Arminio is a poet, and he's actually in Campania. He's based out of in a little village in Irpinia. How do you say that, Daniel? Irpinia? Right. So he lives in that province, and he writes for the major newspapers in Italy. He's quite well known. He's published many, many books, and I've met him, we're friends. But his thing is promoting the small towns and the small villages and trying to get people back to those places and see the value in the slow living that exists there. And certainly, I think it's wonderful. And that's where I take my clients. And oftentimes they're like, where are you taking us? What is it? Why are we going up all these switchbacks to get to the top of this mountain? Where are we going? And once they get there and the people in the piazza come out to see them and ask them who they are and that they're from New York, you're from New York and you're here. You know, these are the moments people remember. This is the stuff that makes travel just, it's magic. It's really magic. Those are the moments. Because yeah, in Rome, no one's going to pay attention to you. Except when you're paying for their food in their restaurant or whatever. So here we have your on the screen is this is one of the craters of Mount Etna. There are many craters, and behind those two people, you can see two more down the hill there. But that is Mount Etna, yes. So
I think an interesting thing though is, you know, think about the two most major volcanoes. Where are they? In the south of Italy.
Yeah,
the fiery.
Like over, well, Vesuvius is like way overdue.
we always have to hope that San Gennaro's blood liquefies, which it did a couple. I think it was last week. His blood liquefied. So we're off the hook for a little bit longer. But again, I think that we really didn't really dive into the food too much about these areas. We took a little bit. We touched on some of the foods, but what are some of the specialties, Danielle, of the Cilento? Is it the tomatoes? Is it the buffalo mozzarella? Is it the special pot? Is there a special pasta? Can you kind of tell us a little bit about some of these specialty foods? Obviously, if you could find this book, which I think is impossible to find in America, you'll be able to try some of these at home. But kind of give us some insight into the foods of the Cilento.
Cilento is like beans and greens and sourdough breads, and it's sort of a slur to call them mandafoglie, leaf eaters, which now obviously, again, if you think about anything healthy, that's what you want to go for. Buffalo mozzarella is definitely the most famous thing, but also Cilento is in Campania, and so Campania is sfogliatella, pizza, like all the things that we know as Italian Americans. They either come from Campania or they come from Sicily. You know, sfogliatella or cannoli or pizza or arancini. So yeah, you have all those wonderful signature dishes that we love as Italian Americans and that we've all gotten to know as Neapolitan food has become more popular. So you know, we're an hour and a half, 2 hours from Naples, depending on traffic. So you get the strong Neapolitan influence as well. And yes, the thing that you can't always replicate here, you can get it kind of on the West Coast where the fruits and vegetables are just, you know, they're more fresh and more vibrant, mm-hmm. especially citrus, but sometimes you just taste vegetables there and you're like, oh, I had no idea. It's like seeing light for the first time. but also too, I think Americans are not so good at cooking vegetables. Actually, I think we kind of go back to like an Irish, English, German heritage of just boiling butter on them. And that's like the best it gets. And so I feel like the best thing, like what I'm trying to do with like having these cooking classes from the Cilento here in New York is like teach people how to cook vegetables so that they're really delicious. Mm-hmm.
And Allison, how about, again, I know we touched a little bit about Sicilian cuisine. You think of the caponata, you think of the eggplant, you think of the cannoli. But I mean, are there some other things that people, you know, that they have to go to Sicily to try?
Well, the fish, the fresh fish, because that's something absolutely I tell my clients, like, please, if you don't like fish in the United States, please don't think you're not going to like fish in Sicily, because first of all, there's so many different fish. But second of all, they're so fresh and it's like nothing else you've ever tasted. So last September, I do a tour called Stirring Sicily. That's one of the tours that I'm still hoping to do this year. It's a cooking and wine tour. The first night I take people to one of my distant cousins' restaurants in Porticello, which is a fishing village outside of Palermo where my grandfather was born. And we had mussels that night. And one of the women said, I never eat mussels. I don't like mussels. And she had a plate of mussels in front of her. She was inhaling them because they taste so amazing. They're so fresh. It's just a whole different experience. But certainly, you know, fresh fish is one thing. And it's very simply prepared because when it's so fresh, it does not need a lot of seasoning or a lot of cooking. It's just, it's just perfect as it is. But what you will find is a combination of ingredients that you wouldn't expect. So you're going to see, like in pasta con le sarde, which is pasta with sardines. Again, do not think of sardines like the sardines you know from a can that you bought at ShopRite. It is not the same thing at all. Fresh sardines are meaty and they're robust. They do taste a little bit like tuna, a little bit. And imagine you combine that with wild fennel, which is a licoricey taste, with pine nuts and raisins. And you put that maybe with tomato, depending on who you're talking to, because everyone has a different take on tomato or no tomato in your pasta con le sarde. Saffron. And you mix this up and you top it with breadcrumbs. So this combination of, you know, why would you put raisins with wild fennel with fish? It doesn't, it's not something that comes naturally to us, but to Sicilians it's very natural. One of my other favorite dishes is pasta with mint and tuna. So that combination, you'll find, of course, mint in a lot of with fish in a lot of French cooking, but that's why you find it in Sicily too, because the French chefs brought French cuisine to Sicily. That's where we get the word monsieur, which comes from monsieur, which was the chefs of the baronial class in the 18th century. They brought 17th and 18th century. They brought this with them, these ideas. But really what we love about Sicilian cuisine is cucina povera, which is poor kitchen, but it's really just peasant food. It's very simple, often based on 3 to 4 ingredients. With, you know, a fresh fish dish and fresh pasta, and depending on the what's in season, that's what you're going to be eating. So right now it's May, so we're going to be at the end of artichoke season. And so we're having a lot of artichokes. If you go in October, you're going to eat everything with porcini mushrooms because that's what's in season. And chestnuts are in season in October, so you'll find that. So that's something about the seasonality of the food is so interesting as well.
It's interesting that you bring up the term monsieur, because my wife was just texting me one of her favorite restaurants, which unfortunately they have since closed, was a place in Philadelphia called Monsieur.
Philadelphia, yes.
That was like that was an awesome Sicilian inspired restaurant, and we had many great meals at that restaurant. But really, also what's interesting about Sicily is that I think that the baking culture or the dessert culture is totally different than the dessert culture in Naples. So you're not finding the sfogliatelle, you're not finding the babas, you're not having the pastiera in Sicily. Sicily is it's almost like a savory sweet in a way. Or sometimes when their sweets are really sweet, sweet.
And that's the Arab influence. The Arabs brought sugar cane, and they notoriously even now have a sweet tooth. So So some of the Sicilian sweets are very, very, very sweet. Like a Cassata cake is extremely sweet. And cannoli too, depending on where you are on the island, you'll find, like in Palermo, you're gonna have very sweet cannoli. It's like 50% sugar to the ricotta. Wow.
Because I always think that for me, a cannolo should be, you should almost taste the cheese. You should almost taste the earthiness. Usually, I guess in Sicily, it would be a sheep's milk cheese as opposed to here where it's mostly cow's milk.
Well, in Ragusa province, they do cow's milk cheese and ricotta in their cannoli in Ragusa province. So note that. But yes, I agree with you, Tony. I think that the ricotta should speak for itself. You should not need to put a lot of sugar in it. You'll find that if you're in more rural environments, you'll get cannoli that the ricotta won't be as sweet because it's naturally sweet. The ricotta speaks for itself. When you go to a more urban location, like Palermo or like Catania, they're going to put more sugar in because they want to extend the life of the ricotta because it's further from the farm and it's a preservative. And so that's why you'll find that. And that's why in New York, our cannoli are super sweet because they want that ricotta to last really long. But also cow's milk ricotta doesn't have a flavor, really. Yeah. It needs to be flavored. So, but this is all stuff we talk about on the cannoli crawl.
have either of you ladies heard of caruba?
Carob?
Yeah.
Carob, absolutely. Yeah, and because you're talking southeastern Sicily, so there's carob trees there, and yes, they have a lot of carob as well there.
We eat that like it's candy. We just what's in the inside of it? The seed. You spit the seed out, but the only problem is you gotta be careful. You can't eat too much of it.
No,
it'll give you a bad stomach ache.
But you can buy that on Arthur Avenue. I bought it at Tidal Brothers. They have it there. Yeah.
Mike Tidal told me that a lot of older guys buy it to use as a starter for wine.
Really?
Oh, really? Yeah. Interesting.
That's mainly why they carry it.
Huh.
Really? Mm-hmm. I didn't know that. I thought they were there to just eat it.
Yeah. I know also they use it as like a, I guess, a chocolate substitute, right? As a sweetener, I guess, to sweeten things.
I feel
really cool thing about the carobs, that's two things that I think are really neat about carob. One is the seeds themselves are always the same size and weight. It doesn't matter what plant you're talking about. They're exactly the same everywhere. So that is where we get the measurement of carats. So when you're talking about gold or diamonds, you know, and they weigh it and it's the carat is the weight measurement.
Yeah.
It is based on carob seeds. That's how you come up with that. So 16 carats is 16 carob seeds because they're uniform throughout, right?
That's unbelievable. Cool
thing. The other thing I learned when I was hiking in Sicily in October, with one of my guides that I work with there, because I'm also getting really into hiking in Sicily and I'm hoping to do a hiking trip in the very near future. But you know that like pistachio trees, which I also learned a couple years ago, carob trees have male and female trees. So for every, say, 10 carob trees, you need one male carob tree to fertilize the female carob trees. And the male carob trees do not make those pods with the seeds in it. Only the female trees do. And what I learned was that the locals in southeastern Sicily didn't understand why these trees were not making pods. So they were cutting them down, thinking, well, these other trees are making pods, this one's not, so let's like cut it down. And then they realized, no, it's a male tree because then the stop making the pods. So there you have it. So, and pistachio is the same. You need one male tree for about every 10.
Wow.
Pistachio trees for them to fertilize them. Yes, cool stuff. So this is the kind of stuff that we talk about.
Before we conclude, there is one other topic I wanted to just touch on a little bit. And again, we could be here all night just talking about this one topic. Is we mentioned it a little bit at the beginning of the show, is ancestry. Like you said, we have a lot of time now on our hands, so we can go on to ancestry.com. We could go to familysearch.org. We could go to MyHeritage. I think there's another one called MyHeritage, something or other. So we have this time to be able to make these connections to our family. And me personally, I was blessed within the last few months since late last year that I reconnected after the last time my cousins in Sicily talked to cousins in America was 1973. So I've been the first Shelia to reconnect with our family there in I guess what is almost 50 years.
What town is it from?
We're originally from Capizzi.
Oh, Capizzi. Okay.
Yeah, but they're in like Cerami and Nicosia. So that's kind of where we're in the center of the kind of like the center. Toward the center of the island. But mm-hmm. but really, so say if somebody wanted to, you know, they're doing a lot of research now and they're hot and heavy into this ancestry. Can either of you ladies can you then I guess create a trip or an itinerary for somebody that wants to go back to these ancestral homes and reconnect with their family, reconnect with the land and with the people?
Yeah, we even do the research for people. That's something that my husband and I, he got his citizenship recently. And so he got like a pro at doing all the research for finding the documents. So it's something that we do often for our clients. And in fact, the past 2 years, the most rewarding trips that I've planned for people who have traveled independently have been these kind of trips where we connect them with distant relatives or experiences in the town or the towns from where their family came. So it's absolutely a huge part of tourism right now. And it's a big part of my business. I love it. I love it. So, you know, those little stories that you have in the back of your head, you remember something about someone from, you know, having a donkey and walking 10 miles, whatever. These things add up and they end up becoming the onion that gets peeled to your heritage. And it's absolutely so special. It's a totally special way to travel.
Yeah, it's one of the reasons I'm glad I work in Southern Italian tourism, because I feel like, again, if people are going to travel after, you know, making this trip, which is so meaningful, is going to be one that people will prioritize. We had because there's not a lot of travel companies in Cilento too, we had a Canadian family get in touch with us who we helped find their roots. Another family in Calabria. My cousin Ariana is a licensed travel agent in Italy, so she's really got an amazing network that she can connect people with. But, you know, there's a lot of stuff that's online. There's a tremendous amount of stuff online. But there are also places that are just tiny little towns that are inaccessible. And you need somebody who's local, who knows how to, you know, give Pasquale some money to open the door. You know, there are places where you need that. And we do connect people with that. And the transformation that comes about is just absolutely amazing. I was just at a wedding before this all happened on February 29th, and I had helped the stepmother of the bride connect with some family relatives. This is an extremely sophisticated, well-traveled person who's been everywhere in the world. And so the afternoon she said finding her relatives in Calabria was the most meaningful travel experience she had ever had. So you cannot underestimate the impact of doing that kind of travel. You can think about it, you can anticipate it, but seeing those things, putting all those pieces together, walking on that land, there is nothing like it.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I was so looking forward to making a trip there this summer, which unfortunately has been postponed.
Postponed.
But yeah, I'm not saying canceled, postponed. But I will get there eventually. I know that. But again, until then, it gives me more time to do more research. But the one thing that I don't know if you guys do any of the ancestral research. Once you answer one question, like 3,000 other questions come up. It's like, oh man, okay. So now I figured this out. But now I have to figure out some more things. So like you said, it's peeling that onion. It's trying to get deep into it. And I personally, almost every day I'm doing something, whether it's on my phone, whether it's on the computer, I'm constantly doing some kind of a research because I think that, you know, in a way, I think it's important that we have a connection to our past. You know, it's great that we move forward and we try to look toward the future. But I think in order to know where we're going, we kind of have to know where our people came from, why we're here. You know, I mean, think about all of our ancestors. You know, again, whether they're Italian, whether they're German, Polish, whatever they are, they made sacrifices for us to be where we are today. And I think that's you know, even in this pandemic, I think it's one thing that we could take away is that we have to just, you know, again, look to the future, absolutely, but also kind of remember everything that went on before us and you know, kind of just move through it.
When you look at, when you go into the ancestry research too, it's, you get a lot of texture and a lot of, like, I always think like, gosh, these people who are long dead are probably like, oh my God, they're finding out all my secrets. You find out about you know, like the families that were adopted, or the husband that left for America and left the Italian family behind and started fresh. I mean, I've found some stuff in my family history of, oh, okay. You find out about all the children that died, you know, before they were a year old. And when, you know, when you get all those stories too, I think you start to have a lot more empathy for people in general, just because you realize that, you know, you might have one story of how your family came to the United States, but then you get to see like all the ups and downs and everything that brought them there. Mm-hmm. And here we are.
Exactly. Here we are.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
So ladies, again, I want to thank you so much for taking some time out. I hope you ladies had a good time. This was great. I really enjoyed talking to you. This was, you know, it's a way to, again, to make this, to keep physically distant, but yet be socially together and to be able to talk about Italy. And I just pray that, you know, within a year or so, that again, I'm sure things won't be the old normal, but it'll be a new normal. And we'll be able to get back to, you know, living our lives, to even, you know, going to our local restaurant and being able to sit outside and have a coffee, or, you know, sit inside, you know, whatever. I just hope that we're able to connect again and you know, kind of, you know, bring back our I don't know, bring back our way of life to a certain extent. But again, I do want to thank you. Before we leave, I know I've been putting the email, I mean, the websites on the bottom of the screen, but just give us a way that anybody that wants to get in touch with you, you know, social media, websites, stuff like that. Danielle, can you start with that?
Yeah, feastonhistory.com or arthuravenuefoodtours.com. We're starting a new session of the Cookbook Club coming up soon, bringing together Italy and Little Italy. And Twitter and Instagram is at feastonhistory. My email is all over the website. Get in touch.
Excellent. And Allison?
Yeah, same thing. ExperienceSicily.com. You can find me there. I post every day a picture of Sicily and something about it usually. Also Facebook, Experience Sicily. I have a page there. Instagram at Experience Sicily. And you can find me on Facebook, certainly. I'm available and happy to talk and happy to email and answer questions and think about the future and when we can go back to traveling again and loving life and celebrating life together, both here in New York, you know, on the cannoli crawl and all the events I host here and otherwise. I'm looking forward to that too. That to me has also been such a huge loss, is just the gathering that we do. And I miss that so much. So.
Well, once this is over, we'll have to get together. I told all the guests, we'll have to get together, have a big meal, a big party, and just, you know, share each other's time and to share each other's company. I think that would be an amazing thing to do. And again, your ladies are more than welcome to ever to come back on the show and to talk about, you know, Sicily, just about the Cilento. So I hope we can set that up. Maybe when things start to get open again, we could do some more, you know, promoting for these beautiful areas of Italy that really deserve the promotion.
And then we can have a pizza 6 feet apart from each other in Lodi.
Yes. Oh, I'm telling you, whatever you want. I was actually at Lodi Pizza today. So I had lunch there today. That's my favorite. That. Well, ladies, thank you so very much for taking some time out tonight. I really, really appreciate it. Check out Danielle. Check out Allison. ExperienceSicily.com. That's Allison's page. We have FeastOnHistory.com. That's Danielle's website. Again, ladies, thank you so much for coming on the show. Tomorrow night, we'll be joined by Paulie G, the one and only Paulie G from Paulie G's Pizza in Greenpoint, Brooklyn. And on Wednesday night, we'll be doing Italian-American Authors Roundtable. So we'll have Ray Guarini on the show, Stephanie Longo, as well as Michelle Messina. They will be on the show on Wednesday night. And then on the weekend, we'll be doing this virtual feast of the La Madonna del Sacro Monte. So stay tuned. A lot going on here at the Table with Tony. We'll see you next time. Ciao for now.
Ciao.
Bye. Thank you.
At the Table with Tony would like to thank its sponsors: Rocco Muriale, Rob Quick, Joseph Cirillo, Raymond Guarini, Tom Gilmore, Ollie G, Peter Ziza, Brian McGuire, Peter Ferreira, Rich Ottenstrauer, Anna Mavrianos, Antonio Pepinella, Anthony Ferraro, Sandra and Bob LaMotta, Mike Guerro, the Italian Enclaves Historical Society,